Welcome back to another episode where today I'm talking to my therapist, my own personal therapist who I've been working with for about 6 years. And I'm excited to give you a glimpse under the hood at some of the stuff that we discuss, as well as trying to destigmatize, humanize who a counselor is in real life so that people who are listening aren't so scared of professional help to see and understand that with the right connection, safety, and calmness, you can get stuff off your chest that you would have previously thought to be impossible. So a few of the technicalities about Lewin's experience. He's a Gestalt therapist. He has a graduate diploma in counseling. He weaves modern relational psychology with ancient earth-based wisdoms gleaned from 15 years of experience in Zen meditation, Taoist arts, Tibetan Buddhism, and indigenous ceremony. He's completed 6 years of training as a counselor and Gestalt psychotherapist, learning from leaders in the fields of both Eastern and Western psychology. Academically, he has written a master's thesis on eco-psychotherapy, as well as a paper on wilderness therapy with adolescents, which is shared with professionals interested in bringing psychological practices outdoors. Furthermore, he leads a consultancy for organizations seeking to learn healthy communication practices through his Raw Circle curriculum. Overall, Lewin is just the embodiment of what a safe, connected, therapeutic relationship can look like. Mr. Lou, my personal therapist. This is an episode long anticipated, mostly by me, but mate, so happy to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When people ask, you know, I've probably referred, I don't know, 30 plus people your way.
Yeah.
And it's so nice to be able to, because I'm not doing one-on-one clinical practice, with confidence suggest someone like you to them. And you have been integral in my healing journey. And I think why that is because you are probably the most non-judgmental person I know. And as per the research in why does therapy work, often it is the quality of the relationship and the container formed more than the actual practical interventions used.
Yeah.
What would you say is like your number one value that you bring to therapy? Like what is something that you hold true?
Well, presence. And, you know, this is a perfect way to, you know, put my money where my mouth is. And you know, as I talk about presence right now, it's like it amplifies it straight away. And it makes me, when I say it's my biggest value, it points me towards a few different values, because as I'm talking about presence, it makes me feel humble, it makes me feel vulnerable, and it shows me how to pick up on things that my mind might not necessarily pick up on, and points me towards the need that person has. And so much of the time needs are unspoken and unconscious, and if I can trust enough in the moment and show up, then those needs usually emerge.
What do you think is, I'm going to throw some big questions at you.
Yeah.
We're going to go around a few places. So what do you think a human being's greatest need is?
To feel safe is the first thing that comes up in my mind. To feel loved, and by love I mean deeply known and deeply seen, and understood. Yeah, but without the safety, without that rest into I'm okay, fundamentally okay, then nothing else can be built upon that. So yeah, safety first, and then love and deep understanding.
What do you think is the greatest way to allow someone to feel understood?
I know it's a bit kitsch to say, or whatever the word is to say, listen, because that's an unfolding lifelong art form, listening. Yeah, but deep listening. And I think I get to deep listening by a willingness to feel in my own body what that person is expressing and feeling. with boundaries, you know, with a sense of, oh, I can feel and resonate what you're experiencing, but I'm over here and I'm resonating, but I'm not over there in your feeling with you. I'm just resonating that.
Mm.
And if I can sit in that balance of open receptivity, then that's pretty magical and healing, I find.
In your experience with people wanting to feel understood, what is the main thing that they want to be understood for when they come to therapy?
Wow, it's a big question. It's so varied.
Mm.
I can talk about some themes. Having a sense of place, like a sense of place in the relationship, and a sense of purpose. And that's definitely one. They want to be understood in their differentness. And often that can come out through a kind of funny roundabout way. Like, I can be doing all these codependent behaviors like rescuing and helping and fixing, but in the end there might actually be a need under there of like, who am I in this?
Mm.
You know, and it's just a funny way of finding that, like, by losing myself in the relationship, actually I end up coming back to, oh well, no, I need adventure in my life, or I need to follow my own happiness.
Mm.
And that sort of thing. So I think, I see a lot of this codependency polarity thing happening, and I see a lot of yearning for individuality, and getting lost in enmeshment.
I'm hearing is a theme of relationship issues, like relationship is a thing. How to relate to others seems to sit at the epicenter of what people are looking for. Purpose feels maybe a little bit different to interrelatedness, but purpose and how we relate to people that are important to us, would they be two themes?
Yeah. And who am I in relationship to others?
Yeah.
I think identity in terms of rites of passage is a big one. So that's what I mean by that is like young mothers who have their little one is turning 2 or 3 or 5 and they're starting to have distance.
Hmm.
And then they're feeling into like, who am I now? Like, I was this businesswoman before or whoever they were before. And then they go into the birth rite of passage and suddenly everything transforms.
Mm.
Their body, their heart, their relationships, and then they come out the other side and they're, who am I now? And I can't tell them who they are. I don't know who they are, but I can support them to discover that, yeah, for themselves.
There's so many people that are scared to go to therapy.
Mm.
What's the biggest misconception you think about those who want to seek professional help but are just petrified of doing so?
Sorry,
What's the biggest misconception that people have about therapy that they're scared of but don't actually need to be scared of?
I think people are scared of being judged and pathologized or confirmed that they're broken, that there's something wrong with them. And they might even be thinking they should go to therapy because, oh, there's something wrong with me. But that's absolutely not the way that I see it or the way that I engage in therapy. Therapy is kind of actually the opposite of that.
Mm.
It's about helping people wake up from their shame and wake up from this illusion of like, there's something wrong with me, I need to fix, like a machine, there's this faulty bit that I can just replace, or maybe it's a pill and I can take and then I'm better. But it's not like that. It's a whole lot more complex and generally longer term than that. It's you're not fixed, you're not broken, so you don't need to be fixed. That's one misconception. But other fears could be stigma, you know, stigma around being weak or feelings are weak. It's weak to feel. There's big stories around that for a lot of people, or it's dangerous to feel.
Mm.
They're two that come to mind.
Have you ever been scared to tell your own therapist something?
Yeah, pretty regularly. Like every few months I come across something that is like, oh damn it. Do I have to go there?
Mm.
It's been a little while since I've had therapy, actually. It's been how long? It's been probably a year and a half or so. Mm. Okay, we're getting real now, but yeah, I lost my therapist, who wasn't necessarily a therapist, but more of like a mentor and a healer and an absolute master, Michael Trembath, a few years ago now. And so I've been recovering from that, and I've had therapy with other people, but I haven't really settled down into a new therapeutic relationship with someone since him. And I think that's partly due to a grieving process, but also a natural process of taking space for myself and going about healing in other ways rather than that one-on-one format. Yeah.
What, thank you for sharing that. What do you miss about Michael the most?
Well, yeah, his deep understanding and holding of me. The sense of how he would hold me, because it was also somatic therapy, so physically, you know, he'd hold the back of my head or gently hold my shoulder or do subtle manipulations. And I didn't get that from older men in my life very often, that intimacy of just holding and with the emotional focus. It was unique, so it would just, I would kind of be like butter to that.
Mm.
And on a subconscious level, I didn't know that it would, you know, it would feel like that. But being held by him enabled me to drop into those deeper layers of childhood vulnerability.
Because we often, when we say, can you hold space for someone, or they've held that emotion, we're talking about metaphorically containerizing a psychological space in which something can be shared and left out in this ether. But in this instance, you're talking about a physical touch almost that when done in a professional way felt incredibly comforting for you.
Yeah, yeah. I like how you say when done in a professional way. I think it takes a large degree of skill and to really hold someone in a safe way.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before, ever.
Yeah, wow. So somatic psychotherapy is one label, or he was a bit of a mixture of different traditions. So from the Ayurvedic healing traditions, but he was also trained in psychology, Western psychology, so and massage and stuff. So he was definitely integrative.
And you talk about your childhood wounds. We all have them, and I think one of the biggest misconceptions, to go back to an earlier point, that many people have about therapy is that therapists have it all figured out. They're the experts. They're on a throne judging you, whereas like almost every single person in the field got into it because of their own shit.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about a formative experience or memory in your life that led you down a path of needing to heal something?
Mm. Well, I mean, I think I know I actually have had this misconception that I started the session with, which was I'm broken, you know, this shame story, from when I was very young, probably around 5, when my dad left, and when my dad and mum separated. So that, I think, was the spark of that story, of that vulnerability. And that seeded within me this illusion that I needed to somehow fix myself. And so thankfully I was so passionate and about exploring that illusion that I was addicted to being a spiritual tourist for like you know, all through my teens and 20s, and maybe it wasn't until mid 20s that I felt like I gave up the kind of seeker search for fixing that I'm broken story. And actually, it's funny I bring up Adyashanti, because he's a Zen teacher from the San Francisco Bay Area, and he had a big impact on me waking up from that story and stopping looking outside for validation and actually just resting into my self and my wholeness and my presence. So yeah, I think Dad's separation from my mum was the tipping point. And then I went on this big journey.
And I know you do a lot of healing work. I mean, you have to, given the space that you hold for other people and how much that can impact you. Has there been an insight? I mean, I'm sure there has been many, but one that you can recall where you uncovered a layer of pain in yourself that changed the way that you viewed yourself? Like, what's a story that you used to tell yourself that you no longer do, other than the I'm broken?
This is one that still comes around. I have to fix other people, fix my relationship, my relationships. I have to, yeah, fix and mend and help. And yeah, it is one that I've been conscious of recently, but I think learning how to listen and learning counseling and psychotherapy and studying psychology, and it's been about letting go of that, ironically, because people perceive these fields as learning how to fix people, and in a way it is, but on a deeper level for me it's about facilitating growth. And I definitely was codependent, or running around trying to help everybody for a little while there, and still do from time to time, but I catch it quicker these days.
Yeah, how do you not jump in when you're seeing a client and you can so very clearly see the path forward of what's hindering their ability, or said another way, might help their capacity to grow, but you know that you just need to sit in that with them for a little while longer so they feel totally heard, validated, and probably will get there on their own? How do you not jump in?
Yeah, that's an ongoing skill of, is this necessary for me to offer a path that I might see, or that I see? I try to get away from that, even if it's here and it's like, I know, I can see, they just need to set boundaries, or they just need to express themselves, or they need to, it's like it's all there. And I think I do my best work when I let that remain there, informing me and waiting for them to come into their own realization. And I also think there's a place for like giving healthy challenge and going, maybe it is about boundaries, or but not going, okay, here's the exact ABCD of how to get there. I find therapy is a kind of dance between facilitation and sometimes offering helpful structures and frameworks. If someone's flailing about going, look, I'm out of control, I need some structure, I'm going to go, okay, now breathe, find your feet, ABCD. But then once they've stabilized, I'm going to go, okay, how do I support you to create moments of that regulation in your life? What do you think? Where do you feel safe and connected? And then off we go.
Yeah, so many people don't feel safe, connected, or okay. One of the biggest questions I always get asked, and I have a viewpoint on how to answer this, but I don't think I've asked you this before. I would very much appreciate your insight. Is mental health issues getting worse, or has it just been that we're reporting on it more? And if things are getting worse with time, what do you think is the main factors driving it?
Whoa, huge question.
Yeah.
Yes, I feel like, in what context are we talking here? How big do we want to go? But
whatever comes up
for you. What's coming up for me is in the Western world, or I'll just talk from my own experience in the clients that I'm seeing, and across, I would say, generally weird cultures, Western industrialized, wealthy white cultures, and then the mental health, it is a big crisis. You know, you probably talk about this all the time, like depression being the leading cause of disability and things like that. That's all a bit heady, though. In my own experience, I hear that people are lost and feeling like they don't really have a sense of like narrative or story behind their life. And there's a lot of pursuit of materialism and success and all this kind of stuff that feels a little bit empty. And it's like, what's my life about, really? Like, what's driving my life? What am I passionate about and what am I interested in? And these questions aren't really, I think they're yearning to be asked, but there's so much chaos on a political political level, on a world level, and there's so many big crises happening, you know, crisis of environmental destruction, crisis of wars and all this stuff going on, that people kind of dissociate and get numb from all of that and then follow this line of, well, I guess I should just be successful and make lots of money because that's the narrative.
Mm.
But what are we living for? And that's kind of sounding a bit of like a religious question, really, or a philosophical question.
Hmm.
But I really feel like there is a big crisis of meaning going on around the world at the moment, and that existential crisis of meaning is part of this big mental health epidemic, along with a bunch of other environmental and dietary stuff.
Yeah, okay. So let's, this is a really good line. I want to keep walking down this path. So what we've heard from you, what I've heard you say is that you do agree mental health issues are getting worse.
Mm.
It's not just that we're reporting on it more. The society is genuinely struggling, particularly in Western white orientated cultures, with the proliferation of anxiety, depression, etc. And if I've heard you correctly, it's a sense of a lack of meaning, purpose, and direction that you think is the core element of that worsening. And so I guess the natural progression of this discussion is, why are people feeling more lost? And in order to answer that question, I guess we've got to go back and say, why weren't people feeling that previously?
Mm.
What's the delta there? So we go and contrast time periods.
Mm.
And then I'd also like to hear your perspective on contrast cultures. So are Eastern cultures less lost and more fulfilled? What can we learn about time and culture?
Yeah. Okay. So the first thing that's coming up for me is that people are lost, and I've felt lost because of, you know, I've talked about meaning and the crisis of meaning. I actually think if we can trace that back, it's more about a connection to nature and a connection to place and a connection to culture. So nature, sense of place and sense of culture, they're all intertwined, and I see that as being the big chasm in like, say, Australian culture or whatever that is, Australian society.
Mm.
The mixed bag of cultures that Australian society is. And I don't like talking on behalf of other cultures, so like I'll be hesitant to talk about that, but I have had experiences in different different Indigenous communities, and I have felt more connected in nature-based cultures. I've felt more of a sense of meaning and purpose, and I've felt more myself on that deep existential level. So I think they have a lot to offer us, and a lot to offer how we heal. So your mental health is just a part of that, but I believe it's a much more holistic thing. Mm. And yeah. Is that
Yeah, no, so that's a, there was more of an identity, it sounds like, and that identity was based in connection and community to something else, whether that be land, whether that be the people who they were surrounded by. That's how you would identify. Whereas maybe now our identity is very much individuated and transient and materialistic in terms of how we identify. And so therefore our connectivity to identity can vanish a lot quicker and feel a lot more non-substantial.
Yeah.
And so are we trying to find meaning in the wrong things, I guess?
I think so.
What is meaning and purpose to you? How would you define it?
A driving force that doesn't come from my mind, doesn't come from just making myself feel safer, or it's not really about me. It's about the network of people I'm connected to and the place that I'm connected to.
Who is there a group of people out in the world who you think or know through data are getting it right from a mental health perspective, and what elements of that works that we can learn from here in the West?
I've felt the most alive and healthy and vibrant when I've been engaging in, I guess I'd call it like the nature connection movement. And that's like a bunch of different communities and crossovers between like rewilding skills and rewilding camps, where you go out with a bunch of families onto usually private land on a river somewhere or in national parks, and you just human together. You just camp and play and engage in nature connection. And that framework was developed by a group of people, well, many groups of people, but particularly who I've loved learning from is John Young and et al. and others. And they, yeah, going to these rewilding camps, like on the south coast with Gigi, and up north, there's Kate and Sam doing their thing with nature philosophy. There's something so natural about that way of being. And yeah, that feels the most holistically healthy. But of course, that's just a lucky, privileged kind of moment in time. And it's kind of like, how can we take the lessons from those weeks out on country together, living and learning how to make fire by friction and learning how to track animals and how to harvest wild food and wild greens and things like that. How do we take those and weave them back into our everyday life in the city or wherever we are? And there's amazing people doing that work. So, yeah.
I'd be interested in what's happening in those moments that you feel most alive. It just so happens to be on country, in nature, blah, blah, blah. What is that actually representing? What need is being met there?
Oh, like every need. Like, need for aliveness and sensual connection to a living world, need for deep understanding and attunement. And I used to go to these camps as a mentor, it's called, and a good mentor asks good questions, doesn't really tell how to go, but follows along, and so mentor for the kids, and it'd be 50 kids and then 30 mentors, and we just go out, and you don't have to be an expert, you just have to be kind of interested and meet them where their curiosity is. And if I'm really into flowers and plants, I'll be like, oh hey, cool, what's this? Or and then engage their curiosity like that, and then it's like, oh, how many petals does it have, what color is it? And that real tangible relationship with nature, like through nature to that other person, that's beautiful and healing, and and meets a lot of needs. It meets attunement, it meets safety, it meets play, all the attachment needs, really.
Attachment's something we work on a lot and I think it informs a lot of your work in how you deal with clients. How would you summarize your clinical approach? I know that you're largely gestalt informed. You use a mentalization approach. You have some cognitive behavioral therapy skills. You flex attachment psychology. Is there any other things that inform your approach to healing?
You covered a lot of the main ones there. I'll always be a kind of gestaltist at heart, whatever that word is. Gestalt therapy is deeply influenced how I view the therapeutic process. And I think that's fundamentally what it is. It's a way of being.
How would you define gestalt for people that don't know what that means?
Yeah. It's the practice of being in the moment together and talking around the moment. It's kind of very Zen in that way, but it looks at how we relate, you know, between the therapist and the client, and then pays attention to particular patterns in that relating, and then takes those patterns of, say, caretaking or intellectualizing or getting into the head or something, you know, and then goes, oh, okay, so that's happening with you and I. Does that happen in relationship?
Yeah.
And then you expand that to the other levels. So that's part of it, as I said, presence, but it's also about embodiment and feeling rather than thinking our way through problems. It's kind of like using our body brain.
Yeah, and I definitely feel all three of those pillars with you whenever I'm in session with you. And I think one of the distinguishing features of Gestalt is that, unlike other therapy modalities where the therapist will be intentionally making you the subject, unpacking your history and trying to like change you and understand your life, a lot of Gestalt and the way we work together is we use whatever's playing out in real time in the way that we're relating as a signpost for the work that I need to then go and do, because our relatedness is unfolding in real time in the accumulation of the conscious and subconscious trauma that is happening over years and decades, kind of playing out in real time right now. And that's why I like it, because there's constant little golden nuggets of green flags of I want attention. Like I'm a thing that lives inside Mitch that wants attention.
Yeah.
And from that, some pretty amazing things can emerge.
Yeah. They say nothing's not the work when you're doing the work. So it's kind of like everything is possibly relevant, doesn't have to be relevant, you know, but when you're doing the work or therapeutic work, it's like you can listen to those little voices of, yeah, pay attention to me or see me or I'm scared or whatever through our play and exploration of what's happening between us. Yeah.
What do you think, switching for those that care, or are interested in terms of my growth, the voices, the narratives, the whatever else that you've seen me evolve, the stories over the years. What do you think is the biggest growth you've seen in me?
Yeah. Wow. That's a hard one. It's like every session we have these, I love working with you because we have these kind of, the realizations are very tangible. I get excited along with you, and but at the same time it's been like I've really loved journeying with you over a long time, because I've seen such a pivot in you from like a settling into yourself, and I see this deep trust or knowing in yourself and your mission and your values that is emerging, particularly at the moment. And you encourage me to step up in that. That's like nice, even coming along on this podcast, it's like, this is a new thing for me. This is a little bit scary, but mostly exciting. And but it's just that you birthed this, you know, and it doesn't surprise me, you know, when you have all of these amazing ideas and projects, and it's like, oh, yeah, of course. But I think you've got to believe in yourself in order to do that. And I've noticed that belief just strengthening and emerging deeper and deeper.
Well, thank you. It's really nice to hear your therapist say that.
Yeah.
What do you think, and by the way, you have my consent to answer as honestly as you want and feel. I have nothing to hide, so you don't need to...
That's courageous.
Yeah. other than only say awesome things, of course. What do you think is the biggest issue that I have faced or still face that holds me back?
You personally?
Yeah.
Wow, nice. Difficulty in slowing down. Yeah. And like resting into real non-doing. Not just like, I'm going to meditate now because I should, you know, 12 minutes and then, but like a deep rest that it's like you can, okay, and then whatever needs to emerge can emerge. Would you say?
100%. Yeah. And my follow-up question was going to be, what do you think the lack of slowing down represents about me? Like, what am I running from?
Are you running
from? Well, what am I trying to run quickly toward?
You know, if this wasn't an interview, I'd flip that back at you.
Yeah, yeah.
But I won't do that.
Yeah.
Look, what's coming up in my mind for whatever reason is I'm enough. Like, a deep sense of I'm enough, no matter what I do. Like, because you're always doing all of these things, but what if you've already made it? And what if that the value, your deep value is not in what you do, is just in who you deeply inherently are? And I think that's what I'm talking about, is emerging in you. But I think as that belief emerges in you, you'll be able to slow down more, and the trust in the spontaneity of life and the progress and these huge goals you have, they're arising, they're already kind of here, but they're coming, you know. Yeah, sometimes I see you get caught in this.
Yeah,
towards the, because I know you've just got such high expectations.
Yeah, I think you and I both know that there's a constant pursuit of wanting to feel lovable, I guess, or appreciated enough, validated, and we've done so much work around it and come a long way, as you say, but there's still a ways to go. And I think some of that speed is driven by insecurity. There is some aspect of high performance that always is.
Some, yeah.
I think for me, one of my main reflections in therapy, and I've told you this before, is that there was a period or a chapter there where we were in survival mode. You know, we were deep in the fucking trenches for a moment there where I was scraping by, particularly after I'd just come back from America and we really kicked off that relationship. And I remember just, you know, I was having suicidal fantasies at the time, and the OCD was crippling, the depersonalization was crippling, and a lot of that work was like just building those bricks and those layers. And what is delightful now is having something to stand on, and therapy has turned more most of the time into how to go from stable and solid to thriving, versus, hey, how do we get me from surviving to neutral? And I think as a therapist, it must be hard, interesting, rewarding, and lots of other emotions to support people at different stages of their journey.
That's why I love like psychotherapy or long-term or medium-term psychotherapy, because it's you get to see all the seasons. I guess, was there a question in that, or is just
more
a reflection?
Yeah, just dropping that in the wishing well, just to see what spun around.
I feel like that. I mean, it's beautiful in the vulnerability and in the depth of helplessness. It's a beautiful place and a really hard place to go there with. Like, it was hard to go there with you because of the care I have for you. But it's, I just know how powerful it is there as well. And that's those moments where it's so helpful not to rescue, but to accompany and go, wow, yeah, I don't know. And then I guess to support you in building those foundations up. And then to see you thriving is just, it's wonderful.
Mm.
So, yeah, and at the same time, like other clients that I work with, sometimes it's just one of those phases and I have to just sit with them and then that's the end of that journey. And maybe it is just sitting with them in deep pain and I don't get to see the roses or there isn't roses at the end. And so, yeah, it's a privilege when I can have the whole.
Do you believe to that point that connection is the greatest medicine for mental health?
Yeah. Yeah, whatever connection is, right? This is what I guess this podcast is about. It's like, what is connection and that mystery? But yeah, the true felt sense of being connected to another person and accepted and loved. I think that's the essence of therapy.
To allow yourself to be connected enough safely to someone else to heal the wounds of not feeling enough, maybe.
Yeah, to heal the wounds of when you didn't feel connected or you felt disconnected.
And I don't know if this is too reductive and overly simplified, but maybe that one of the single greatest things we can do as a society and as a world to try and reverse the trend of mental ill health and suicide is to cure disconnection. Or at least mitigate and reduce it as much as we possibly can.
Yeah, cure disconnection. I mean, I don't know if we can. I think disconnection is always gonna be there. But for me, I feel like the best thing I can do is get as connected as I can to my body, to my feelings, to the food I eat, to the people in my world. And to, you know, to my clients and friends and my community, that feels like the work. And yeah, and it feels, I have hope in that, in trying to kind of keep it simple in a way. Like what is, I start with my body, I start with my food and my sleep and foundations, and then just try my best to nurture myself. And that sets me up to be in an available place to show up for other people. You know, and I guess that's where the challenge is I rush around like everyone and I get lost in doing and anxiety and stuff as well. And it's just that ongoing journey of like, oh no, slow down. Okay. Sit, just enjoy the coffee, enjoy the sit at the river or be here with my mum or my brother. Just be there. Just drop everything. Yeah.
Do you ever get traumatized? I mean, I get asked this all the time, working mental health, how do you keep going? Because there's so much energy coming your way and so much pain that you're holding for other people. Mm. I don't do one-on-one. I, you know, use other vehicles like speaking and entrepreneurship and stuff, but you do. And do you ever feel like you take on too much and as a result experience vicarious trauma? And B, what do you do to prevent that and then treat that?
Yeah, I think maturing as a therapist, I mean, I've been in this therapy game officially for 11 years and kind of unofficially before that as a teenager, but you know, in my early 20s to now, and I'm 34, yes, I've had, I think as I've matured, I've had times of my boundaries coming down and I'm absorbing too much and taking too much on, and say not going to supervision as much as I needed to, not dancing as much as I needed to, not going to jiu-jitsu or meditating enough, etc. Like filling my cup and establishing my energetic boundary, which is flexible and absorbs and allows for connection and love, but also helps me separate from stuff that might not be mine. But like high levels of dysregulation, I don't need to meet the client or meet, you know, the client in that. I can notice them going into their overwhelmed lizard brain, but I can stay in my own grounded safety in my body, the feeling of my bones. And I think that's just an ongoing process. There's been one time where I was working a lot at a psychiatric hospital, and just the sheer volume of work and the sheer volume of people that I'd see in groups that I'd run every day, that just kind of slowly eroded my boundaries. And then I was pretty close to burnout when I left. And well, I didn't leave. I went from full-time to day programs and started doing 3 days a week with the outpatients rather than the inpatients.
Mm.
And that was a really healthy move for me. And I was able to recalibrate and go, whoa, that was too much. And I've kind of ever since then been slowly working less and less and try to see how little can I work and still be satisfied and pay the bills, but like be, yeah. But I really am trying to value my time with my wife more and, yeah.
And someone else soon.
Yeah. And a little one coming in December. So that's going to be happening more and more, you know, like now I'm just trying to compact my hours in the day and work around all these different boundaries to as mean that I'm showing up as best I can for her. And I think that's really important. And so how to prevent burnout?
As in this space, yeah.
In this space and vicarious trauma particularly, embodiment is key.
Say more.
And
what does that mean?
So what that means is, you know, I was talking about this bubble thing, like one, being able to be affected and attuned by the other person's emotions, but having a sense of my own breath. And so it's like, oh my God, that's, you know, the stuff I hear and that we hear is sometimes just like heartbreaking. But allowing myself to have my heart broke and allow that energy to move and not tensing into it. Mm. So it's like, and allowing my breath to soften, my muscles to relax, so I don't tense into the difficulty of where that person's going. And
I think where you're going is you feel and then it moves through you and you let it go.
It's through, like you said, hold.
Yeah.
And I didn't really agree with that. I don't really hold people's emotions for them, although I think subconsciously that can happen, because vicarious trauma in a way is kind of like my own personal traumas and difficulties resonating with that person's trauma, and it shows me where I haven't, the places I haven't met. So being a therapist is a very honest and vulnerable job, because it will show me what I need to see.
Yeah.
And it has, and it kind of does.
Whether you want to or not.
Yeah, whether I want to or not. Like, I have to be open to that. If I'm not, then I'm just kind of cut off and, I remain too in my head.
Yeah, it's tough. I think the real-time embodiment is key, which is the active feeling with someone and then letting it move through you. I always imagine it like a conductor of energy, not a container for it. Like if lightning hits the metal pole, it feels it and then discharges it.
Yep.
Whereas a bucket will fill up and up and up and eventually overflow.
Mm.
And, you know, even though it's not the same as you, because we share different experiences, I know that when I hear people's stories, I hold it with them, and then I sometimes have mantras or behaviors that I'll do in order to let it go. Like I'll say out loud, this is not mine to hold. I'm giving this back now. All my behaviors will be, I'll go and shower or I'll run in order to like cleanse.
Mm.
Or I'll pray for someone. And that's kind of like my bookend to say, I can't hold this right now.
I give it over.
I'm giving it up.
Yeah.
And so it becomes like a triad instead of a jewel.
Yeah.
Do you have behaviors or belief systems that help you stay regulated in boundary to other?
Yeah, great. One is I'm not responsible for their journey and their healing. Yeah, even though they might sometimes come to me in like, help fix me, like solve my problems, it's like I'm here to support you, and then I do have a real mental process of I show up as best I can and then I let them go. I let them go back into their field, their life, and I kind of in a way pray in a non-religious sense, just like that they get the support they need. And I orient them towards that support. And sometimes it is sad when they isolate or they don't have access to support if they're in a difficult spot. But yeah, I think it's a shift for me. It's like, okay, after the session I let them go, but sometimes I don't, and I have to catch myself, like, is it 7 p.m. at night and I'm having dinner and I've still got a client in my mind somewhere? If that's happening, that's one of the indicators, like, okay, no, I haven't like let go of work for the day. Or I'm doing emails too late or that kind of thing. So I think boundaries for me, like very practical boundaries, as in like my general boundary I try to keep to, and I'm not perfect, but after 6 p.m. it's like, off. I'm off. Occasionally I'll message someone a podcast link or something like that, but I try not to, because it blurs the line. And then
Have you ever been so moved or touched by someone's story that you have been unable to work with them?
Not that I've chosen. I haven't actively said, no, this is too much, or this is too close to home for me. I haven't actually had that experience yet. But I have worked with some people where, I don't know, for whatever reason, that kind of just happened. Like, we had a few sessions and I was kind of like, whoa, this is hard. This is a big one for me, and I'm getting activated. And then they haven't continued the session. Maybe it was subconsciously kind of expressed. There's been a couple of times where it wasn't really a fit. But I didn't have to make that explicit and say, look, this is too much for me. I haven't felt like it was ever too much. I probably could go with trying that out more. Actually, my supervisor did suggest that recently with someone that I was like not sure about working with, and he was like, you're about to have a baby, what do you reckon? You just say, yeah, I can't do this. And I didn't end up doing it. It's a confession. I ended up regulating some fears I had around this person and sharing these fears with the client. And then as I did that and helped them create more support in their life, I felt less pressure and was like, oh, they're actually more supported than I realized.
Yep.
Again, I can't fix them.
What do you look, you know how as help seekers, as clients, as humans, when we're actively going out and trying to search for professional help, I coach and we are coached to assess a fit, you know, are you with the right therapist? And largely that's based on connection and safety and all that stuff. What does a therapist do to assess fit of a client? Like, what are some of the things you ask yourself to be like, this is good for, from my perspective too?
Yeah, well, I actually have a little caveat on my intake form that says, I do not work with people A, B, C. And I'll just share some of mine. Sure. I mean, it's pretty personal, but one of them is I don't work with people at the moment actively involved in court cases or soon to be involved in court cases. I've done that work before. And even though I state that boundary, you know, still like... I've still ended up working with one. that was something that arose later through the course of therapy. It wasn't as we started the journey, and I've chosen to stay with her through that, and I'm actually very grateful for that. But it takes a lot more holding than a traditional journey. There's a lot more complexity and time that it takes outside of those sessions that I just don't have space for right now with my current life situation. So that's one. I literally put that on the intake form. So I guess that's part of the ascertaining. The second is, I'm just forgetting them. If you're engaged in addictive behaviors and aren't willing to be abstinent from them and then get support around that. That doesn't mean you have to be perfect and never have a relapse. It just means like,
Are you at a point of acceptance?
You can't keep. And, yeah. Are you in denial or not?
Yeah.
If you're in denial, yeah. I can't work with you.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like, if it's really important that therapists work with people through the denial process. I've also just done that for some years, and then now I'm just like, no, I need you when you hit rock bottom and you're ready.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one of my others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when you're in the room with someone, when are you like, yeah, I think this is going to be really beneficial for them. What's some qualities that you see in someone coming into therapy that often leads to better outcomes than not?
Well, I'll go along with what two elders in psychotherapy world suggested, which was the ability to focus, they called it focusing, or tune into their felt sense. The embodied bodily felt sensation of emotion.
So someone who's willing to feel their feelings.
Yeah, or even, yeah, who's willing to even learn or remember how to feel the knot in the gut or the tightness in the chest, like, and to make the journey through dissociation, through numbness into the body, because that's where the emotions can be felt and cleared. We can't really just do it through the head. No, we can't do it through the head alone.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what's another attribute off the top of your head?
The felt sensing capacity, and that's a huge spectrum. The second is, willingness, but that's so vague. Like,
a want to get better despite it being tough.
It could be so hard. It could be so terrifying to be seeking help, but some sort of willingness.
Hmm.
The people that tend to really do really well is have other supports in their life as well, or are prepared to start to create those. It's like, oh, I've got no friends that don't drink. It's like, okay, well, yeah, wow, that's, yeah, of course. And, well, are you willing to find other avenues?
Mm.
To find other connections so that you can give up that alcohol, or, you know, as an example, it's like the willingness to actually shift their lifestyle. What doesn't work is people going to therapy and being like, oh, okay, I need the silver bullet, and then I'm just going to go back and just go back into my same thing. It's like, no, you, like, therapy's like a practice for like, oh fuck, now I have to do what I said that I was going to do. I'm going to go to the gym, or I'm going to,
the doing is the hard part, the knowing is the easy part.
Yeah.
Is there this is some left field questions that I'm just genuinely curious in. Is there a mindset or a cognitive thought process that you have seen to be almost universally beneficial to someone in or outside of therapy, just if for mental health in general? What is like a thought that is very helpful to have?
A mindset. I don't know.
That's your answer, or the mindset?
No, the mindset. The ability to say, I don't know, and the willingness and the humility to be in the unknown and wonder. I know a big part of my journey was thinking I knew a lot. I had to know in order to be loved, right? To be clever and to seek love through knowledge. And so one of my mentors saw me in a receptive moment, and she went, hey, Luke, can I give you some feedback? And I was like, yeah. She's like, I just saw you really in your I know. And it'd be really interesting for you just to practice just catching that every time you want to go, I know, and have that energy towards someone. And yeah, that begun the unraveling, and I'm still going through the unraveling. I know I'm the expert. I do it heaps still, actually. But anyway.
We're all a work in progress.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The stories can be so entrenched in our DNA, and I know is one of many things that I think we all are wrestling with at any point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And it does take work to create a new reality for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think people can change?
I see people change all right. the time. And I guess you're trying to get to like, yeah, what are these change agents? What are these qualities of change? Like, yeah, so willingness and openness and perseverance, dedication to feeling through the suffering and knowing that there is another side, but the willingness to feel, and I guess the dedication to doing the work.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's planned this way in almost every session for the whatever 6 years I've seen you. We always tend to come back to one underlying emotion, which is shame. And I don't know if that's just with me or you find that with lots of clients, that there's a seed emotion that seems to do most damage in most of life, which is shame, right?
Yeah, I read somewhere once that shame is the core constellator of all feelings, something like that. And I really have been contemplating that. I feel like it's generally true. There's probably areas that it's not true. It's usually a constellation of like shame and fear, or shame and anger, or shame and loneliness, and it changes for each individual.
I.e. emotions that relate to connectedness, or said another way,
yeah,
the consequences of disconnection.
Yeah, well, because I think when trauma happens, it shame accompanies the initial nervous system blowout, you know. So when something overwhelming happens, our nervous system gets too much energy rushing through it and we blow a fuse. That's one thing that we've got to treat, like the rebalancing of the nervous system. But then for some reason, the accompanying, there's something wrong with me, or I made a mistake, or it was my fault, or the shaming that happens with it, it seems to be universal. And we got to also deal with that. So recovery from trauma is recovering, yeah, those two things together, as well as a whole lot more than that. But they're the two of the core aspects.
There's so many things I want to ask you. I will turn to a couple of questions that some people submitted through the Q&A that I put live on Instagram. I can't get to all of them, but here's a couple. Rapid fire. You don't need to go deep on any of these.
Yeah. All right.
can someone avoid going to therapy but get better?
Well, yeah, there's many paths to healing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to say more? Oh, that's good. Double click once more on that.
Yeah. If they're creating connection in other ways in their life, then it can be possible to heal. But if they think that they can isolate into their suffering and continue to try to just grit and bear it through it,
deny, avoid, shame.
Yeah, or just to figure it out and try to do it by themselves, I just don't think it's going to be very hard to do that. People can do that. People are incredibly resilient. But when shit happens, get connected.
What do you think is the goal of mental health? What do you think the goal of healing is too? What does the end destination look like?
Far out. The goal of mental health. Being how we are.
What if how you are is hurting?
Well, then the full acceptance of how we are can enable a transformation and a meeting of that hurt. And hopefully then compassion and self-love will arise through that. So
how do you know you're there? How do you know that you're mentally healthy?
When your life reflects that back to you through healthy relationships, through loving people, through a sense of engagement in your where you are. I think how you know when you're not healthy is when you're isolating, and when you're feeling like your body's not your own, and you're feeling lost and confused, or feeling like you don't know where to turn. So I guess it's much harder to define health and wellness than it is to flip it like.
Well, how would you define mental illness?
Disconnection from either your body, other people, or the universe, the world around you. Now, that's a holistic perspective on that. And then the subsequent imbalances that arise within your your mental patterns and your emotional patterns. So it's so hard to bring it down into a mental health problem, because mental health is physical health, and vice versa, and is environmental. So like, I don't really see it that way. That's why I'm struggling with this answer, because it's like, you know, anxiety, which I define as, you know, the difficulty in disengaging from fear-based, often future-based thinking, and getting lost in a cognitive realm with that fear, and disconnecting from the fear as it's felt in the body. So then see how I, like, in defining anxiety, it has to be about where the imbalance is and where the disconnection from the embodied sense is.
So am I oversimplifying it if I say mental health is where one feels connected and mental illness is where one feels disconnected?
Well, yes, but and I know people want these like simplistic definitions and things like that, and that's the tricky tricky thing is they're not simple.
Yeah. It just challenges us to put to go into like, what is this really? You know, when we're forced to define something simply, I think it's a good push to
get to the essence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I could do better at that. Like, what is mental health? I think it's many things. It's free floating ability to be adaptable and flexible, to have a sense of energy and motivation, you know, healthy levels of dopamine. It's like the ability to self-regulate and calm ourselves. Having, as I've said before, vision and purpose. It's so many things.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this capacity to be both able to be tangential in your thinking or divergent in your thinking, but also be able to concentrate and track. So yeah, there's so many aspects of the mind though. Maybe just a balanced mind. That could be one way of putting it.
Dan Siegel defines it as integration.
Yeah, integration. Yeah, like vertical and horizontal integration on brain, on brain states. Yeah.
Or said another way, the absence of rigidity or chaos.
Yeah, so that's kind of balance. So maybe that's my end answer. Yeah. Lock in balance.
Mind. Deal. Lock in balance. Some other things that we got here. What's the best way to detach from pain? I guess attach to pain.
Not necessarily attach.
Yeah.
But get as close as is safe to pain and tolerate the pain without falling into it or detaching from it.
And as a result, the pain will, you will grow the strength to hold that pain and it will move through.
And then, yes, exactly. You grow the strength to be able to meet the pain and then, yeah, and then release it. And then the emotional blockage doesn't stay blocked. It is able to flow.
When people say, I need to work through something, I need to process it.
Mm.
Are they effectively saying, I need to feel it in order to let it go? Or are they saying, I need to build strength to it so that it can stay as voluminous as it already is? It just feels less because I'm stronger. Like, does the emotion reduce or does your capacity to hold it increase, or both?
Both. I think capacity comes through strengthening to, as we strengthen our feeling of, say, our ability to stay mindfully present and our presence on our, on say safe parts of the body, like the feeling of the weight under the, on your sit bones or your ribs breathing. When that is strong enough, or you've connected enough times to those sensations, then the scary sensations of the big emotions can flow within that. And so first is building those foundations, and then secondary comes that more surrendered, more feminine willingness to let the feelings flow.
Do you believe that an emotion, or let's say this another way, do you believe that a wound, an emotional wound, a trauma, a negative experience needs to be felt in order to be healed? Like, can you ever bypass feeling the negative shit in order to feel better? Or is there a tax to be paid every time?
Yeah, you can't bypass it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go over it. You can't go over it. You got to go
gotta
through
go
it.
Got to go through it. Yeah. And, yeah.
And that could be easily taken the wrong way and people would be like, feel your trauma. Rah! Yeah. That doesn't work either.
Yeah.
So it's like the skill of the skill, the art of trauma recovery is feeling in a safe way.
Mm.
So that your nervous system just doesn't get re-traumatized again.
Mm. Do you believe mental health, mental ill health is more caused by the nature or nurture?
I'm going to have to go both, but it's
genetic or environmental?
If I had to pick one, I had to pick one, it'd be nurture, but it's absolutely both.
Yeah, yeah.
But I say that because of epigenetics and the what my experience is that we can change our blueprints.
Mm.
We can change our genetic inheritances. And yes, we might have certain genes switching on certain beliefs.
Mm.
But we can change the way that they're expressed and how those genes express certain potentials through repetitive embodied action in the world.
Beautiful. Some random ones here. Is it normal to sexually fantasize about an ex?
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that. I hear that every now and then. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
Is it normal to be friends with an ex?
Yes, absolutely. I think what this person might be getting at is, I mean, I can only imagine, but it depends. It always depends. So, like, yes, it's normal to be friends with an ex, but I would also say that usually it takes a long time to learn how to unravel the cords and disconnect in a healthy, loving way. And usually it does take a time of distance and space to really come back to self before you can have a friendship that's not actually subconsciously still connected on like a sexual level or on other levels of dependency. So I do always suggest taking that slow and taking time and actually having periods of separation before you try and be friends again.
Mm.
As a generalization. Yeah.
Agree. Have you ever been intimidated by a client?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I often get intimidated by really successful entrepreneurial people, kind of like yourself, but I have other clients that I'm really inspired by and they're really, you know, doing these incredible things for the world and for the planet. And I'm just like, whoa. And sometimes I have insecurity around that. Mm. I'm like, well, you're seeing me? yeah. Yeah, but
quickly, it's a nice bit of vulnerability.
Yeah, but quickly that vulnerability, that insecurity leaves as we develop the connection.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, for sure. I mean, I am inspired by your ability to hold emotion the way that you do, and connection, and the same thing that you're seeing in others, people are admiring about you, right?
Yeah, that's what
just in different flavors.
Yeah, a friend of mine reflected that to me.
Yeah,
a long time ago, and I'll always remember that. I was seeing something really deep in him, and like, wow, it's like describing this bear-like stability and this amazing strength of character that he had, and he's like, you know, you're just starting to see that in me because it's emerging in you.
Mm.
Like, I know that was a deflection back to me, but it was true. I was starting to realize my own bareness and projecting it on him. Yeah.
Well, this has been an incredible discussion. We're going to walk this home with a couple of final questions. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Oh, gosh, I'm just filing through
the plethora of advices. What's something you live by?
Oh, yeah. Reality is not something to be fixed or healed. It's something to be recognized. So I took that to mean like healing and myself is not something to be fixed. It's just to, there to be recognized, and that deep recognition and deep seeing and the surrender into that. That's been really powerful for me. I don't need to be fixed. I just need to be recognized.
I love that.
Yeah. That's the one that's coming to mind. So much of the time, it hasn't been about words that I've really held on to, but a feeling and a knowing and, you know, sitting there with, like, my adopted grandmother, and she's just this mountain of a woman, this elder, you know, and she just seeing her shift from this playful little child to like just this huge presence. Yeah, that I'll never forget that.
The feeling versus the words.
Yeah, it's an experiences of being held and understood and inspired and watching, you know, mentors of mine run up a mountain at 60. Like, that's what I remember.
Is there something that you wish I'd asked you during this podcast that I haven't?
No, it's been beautiful, but I was just thinking as I talked about one of my mentors running up a mountain, we didn't get into the whole rites of passage, men's stuff, like, and that is something that we've talked about before. And that's a whole field of interest and passion of mine. I'm definitely no expert in it, but I just love the question of what would the world be like with modern day rites of passage that are tailored to the individual and the community, and it's happening more and more, but I really feel like part of how we get out of this mess is through reimagining nature-based rites of passage for all types of people, whether it's menzies for young women, menzies rituals that is also emerging, or not emerging, re-emerging for in many communities, but or similarly puberty rites of passage for young men. I think it's absolutely so important. And I was talking to in my own men's group this last week, we were talking about this quote that I heard somewhere: if you don't initiate them, or the village will burn. And I've heard it's been tied back to an African community that said it, but it fills me with like terror and sadness at a realization of what's happening to our world right now, and in the disembodied adolescent leadership that's all over the world. But it also fills me with hope, because I see the power of initiation and power of ritual and ceremony to transform people's lives. So I'll hold on to that.
That's so nice. Yeah, that comes back to your feeling before around, or your comment before around, you like to see things in action versus hear them being told to you. You remember things more like that. And I think that that's true in therapy. Like, there's a lot of healing that's come by simply observing you with me. Like, I've become more calm, not because you told me to be more calm, but because I've watched you be more calm and feel you be calm. I am now embodying calmness. It's a great way to learn, I think, a great way for therapy to unfold as well. Rapid fire, what are three things that you do to maintain your mental health?
balance my sleep, low carbohydrate based diet, and daily connection to nature. That there's so much more, but that's just the three. Yeah, make sure my sleep is good, diet is good, and a nature connection every day, like gardening or walking out in nature.
One book you would recommend people read?
The Tao Te Ching, particularly by Lao Tzu, Laotzu. It's an ancient 2,500-year-old collection of poems from the, you know, you could call it an indigenous Chinese philosophy. But I particularly like Stephen Mitchell's translation of the Tao Te Ching. It's Taoteching. That's changed my life, that book. I got it when I was 14 and I'm still reading it and going, what? Yeah.
And last but not least, if we were to never speak again, which we obviously will for many years to come, but what note would you leave for me to remind myself to listen to in my ears?
Everything will be okay.
That felt right.
It's just what came up.
Mm.
It's the feeling, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the feeling.
Mm.
Brother, thank you so much. I know that it's a rare insight to and a rare experience for someone to interview their own therapist and for the therapist to agree and be let in like we have to your mind, to your views, to our relationship. And I think that's pretty special. So massive thank you, brother. Much love.
So welcome. Yeah, it was a real pleasure. I feel fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Mm.